Tonight on Arena, Rachel Kushner on her new novel, Creation Lake, and Robert Ames on performing iconic gaming scores with the RTE Concert Orchestra. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena, and you can watch us on rte.ie/arena. We start this evening with Dublin Theatre Festival, which runs from the 26th of September through until the 13th of October, including over 30 productions featuring new voices as well as familiar faces, a wealth of Irish and international work exploring stories of family, identity, migration, climate, colonial legacies, conflict and its resolution. And this kitchen sink would probably be in there as well, I'm guessing. Three of those new voices are in studio with me this evening. Ross Dungan, who'll tell us a story, who tells us in his play Content, rather, a story about the role of content moderators for a social media company. Amy Kidd and her play Breaking, about how boundaries are crossed in relationships and control shifts as a result. And Dee Roycroft on her play Amelia, stories about a near future exploring birds, migration and leaving home. Delighted to have Ross, Amy and Dee all with me in studio on this Monday evening. I guess having a play in the Dublin Theatre Festival for, if I can refer to all of you as emerging voices, I think that's probably reasonable to say, it must be a huge kind of rubber stamp of approval for you. How did this is your debut play at the festival, or is it a debut play as well, Ross?
It's a debut play at the festival. Yeah, it's a. I don't know if rubber stamps are supposed to be terrifying by their very nature, but it is. It's unbelievably exciting. It's a huge opportunity. It feels like, whether you realize it or not, you've kind of been sort of working towards something. So it feels very special, and yeah, you just feel an awful lot of gratitude for the people who you've worked with in the past and people you're working with at present to make the whole thing happen.
Yeah, and while it's not the end destination, it's obviously an important stop along the way, or an important maybe milestone along the way. You're in the same situation, Amy, as Ross. Is it a debut play and a debut at the festival?
This is my first play ever. And I just, yeah, I'm hugely fortunate. Fish Amble, the new play company, the fact that they, you know, took a chance on me, commissioned a first-time writer and chose to make it their festival offering. I'm just enormously grateful to them.
Because Fish Amble are well known for their support of new writing.
But this was
an unsolicited script, which is highly unusual for an unsolicited script to make its way to production.
Yeah, I cold emailed it through their unsolicited script submissions. So any writers out there that are wondering, does
Can
that ever
you do
happen?
It?
Yes, it happens. Do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the moment when, I mean, most writers, again, without making a cliche out of it, you're used to getting the thank you for your submission, maybe some comments on how you might improve it, or maybe, you know,
the thanks,
it's
but no
not
thanks.
For us.
Yeah.
Yeah. When you got a response, that what was the nature of that initial response?
They asked me in for a meeting with Jim Cullerton and Gavin Kostick. And I had met Gavin before because I trained as an actor at the Lear Academy. And Gavin was my dramaturgy teacher. So he was a familiar face. I had met Jim, but I didn't really know him. And yeah, I was really nervous to go in for that first meeting. And then they were so encouraging and they were so enthusiastic about the play. And we just had such a creative conversation. And then they optioned it. So then there was a period where they workshopped it with actors and kind of tested it out. And then they commissioned it.
Well, we talk about the specifics of what you did in that workshop and the nature of the play itself. But let me go to Dee before I start talking about the specifics of each of the three plays. You and I have soldiered on stages in Dublin in the past, for sure, Dee.
Yeah.
But how new a departure is writing for you? And this, I think, is the debut at the festival as well, isn't it?
Yes, it is. So I suppose I've been writing for a few years, but not in theatre. I've been writing a bit in animation and a little bit of fiction. But this is definitely, this is a new departure for me. I actually wrote a play way back, I was just saying, in 2009 in the Fringe Festival, but I didn't know how to have people talk to each other. So everybody just sort of stood and spoke out at the audience. So hopefully we've come on a little bit since. Writing for me has definitely been a very slow burn, but it's something I've been passionate about for a very long time. So yeah, so I'm really excited and thrilled. Yeah, but I got into it, I guess, around the pandemic. That's when it started. I think it started for a lot of people then. I think that's when a lot of people had the time.
That's when I wrote my play.
Yeah, and I think it was really fruitful, you know, to have that kind of space because creativity needs that space. And so that was when I was trying to write a thesis, and as an act of procrastination, I signed up for...
Let's write a play instead.
To write a play. Yeah.
And a pandemic baby from you, Ross, in terms of the play, or did it come from a different point in time?
Absolutely from the pandemic, yeah. It was at a time when the producer I work with, Matthew Smith, was kind of just sort of saying, you know, we had other things that were closer to being in production, and then he was like, there is no way of doing anything at the moment, so do you have any ideas that we can kind of, you know, things we can put on a development slate? And that's where this whole thing kind of sort of came out of being like, well, if I'm forced to have an idea right now, it's probably this one.
Yeah, and you're in the world of social media, which I guess is kind of feeds very well into that pandemic period. What exactly, you're looking at, content is the title of the play.
The play is content, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so what part of social media and what part of content are you looking at in the story?
Yeah, so just to explain briefly to people who might be unfamiliar with the occupation, the play concerns the work of content moderators. Content moderators, again, some people might not know, but some people might know, they are people basically employed by, let's just say Meta or a social media company like that, and flagged content. People will flag different posts, videos, things that they might be offensive or inappropriate for a variety of different reasons. And they are all moderated by different people sitting at a screen with queued images of flagged posts coming up.
And it sounds as if you have been in a room with people looking at screens with queues of flagged images coming up.
The thing is, I absolutely never have at all. I've talked to people and obviously like researched the whole thing because I'm writing about it, but it is a very secretive, very, very opaque process. People are quite, I mean, if you're speaking to people, it's generally off the record because they are NDA'd out the wazoo. For different social media companies, non-disclosure agreements.
You have two moderators as characters here. Now the cast is bigger than it, but Alan and Alana.
Yeah.
Now those names are quite similar. What's going on between the two moderators? Are we at opposite ends of the scale? One who lets anything go, and one who won't let anything go through, or what is it?
They're very, very different temperaments. Yeah, and one, I suppose one is doing the thing just kind of as a job, and then something kind of quite shocking happens in their life, which kind of kickstarts the plot of the whole play. And the other character, the main character, Alan, is someone who I think really believes in the work as well, because that was something that in my kind of research and, you know, going through this whole thing of like, this is a horrible job that people have to do. It's such a difficult job. But a lot of people doing this job, they also find there's quite a lot of value in it as well, because they are removing, you know, really horrible images that other people, so other people don't have to see them as well. And it's just something the play kind of grapples with, of the necessity of the task and how these people are treated, and all those kind of things go into the big soup.
Yeah, and I mean, part of it is the dynamic here. There is a comic element to it, but clearly from what you're saying, there's a very serious side to it as well. And quite a serious side, I think, as the starting point for your play, Amy, called Breaking.
Yes. Yeah, so my play, I'm assuming that's the segue.
Yes. That statement. That statement was a question, yes.
I've removed the elegance of it now, so I apologise. But yeah, so my play is about two characters called Sam and Charlie who are in a relationship. And yeah, it deals with, like you said, kind of boundaries being crossed. There are some themes of abuse, of coercive control, and one of the other, I suppose, unusual things about the play is that the characters Sam and Charlie are played by four actors. So we have a cast of four. And so we see Sam as a man, a woman, and a non-binary actor. And we see Charlie as a man, a woman, and a non-binary actor. And the four actors are kind of custodians of these two characters and their story. And they sort of pass the baton. I won't go into exactly how that works. I won't take the tricks away. But
what's interesting, I think, in what you're saying there, so we see these four actors playing the different roles along the way.
Yeah.
So it's not as if we see Sam and Charlie at whatever, 21, 30. Because initially when I heard they play by different actors, I thought, oh, yeah, we're going to see them at different parts of their life.
Yeah, no.
But it really I get the sense of, this could happen to anybody. This can happen to any of these actors stroke characters.
Yeah, that is definitely a big part of my intention. You know, when I started writing about the subject matter, you know, there's a reason, I think, why we most often see these themes with, you know, a woman that is perhaps being abused by a man, because statistically that is, you know, still most common. But I think that sometimes people get left out of that conversation, that part of the conversation. Of course, we still need to tell stories down that vein. But I wanted to see what would happen if we kind of went, okay, what if we look at this relationship and then now it's two men and now it's two women and now there's a woman that is perhaps exhibiting these dynamics, these behaviours as well. And so it kind of shifts our perspective. What also happened once I started kind of workshopping this, even pre-Fish Amble, just grabbing actor friends of mine and saying, oh, I have this idea and I don't know if it's going to work and let's read this and see if we follow it, if it's clear for an audience and if there's kind of artistic merit in it. And what also happened then was people started going, oh, interesting, when I saw that person play that character, I kind of, I gave them the benefit of the doubt. I didn't think that was gaslighting. I thought that they were, you know, I trusted them and I thought, oh, they've just made a mistake. But when I heard it out of that mouth, it seemed really insidious. It seemed really controlling.
So the same words, essentially, was it spoken by a different actor, became something totally different?
That's great. Yes. So it kind of, you know, my initial intention had been, you know, is there a way of opening up this subject and kind of including all of these different, an everyman or an everywoman of relationships, and then also seeing, okay, what our biases, our prejudgments, our expectations around not only gender, but, you know, race and class and accent and all of this different, these different components aspects of our humanity.
Yeah.
And so it kind of, I was like, wow, it works. It says something and it says more. And so we've continued exploring those trains of thought as well.
Dee, you're bringing us to the future. I don't know how near this future is or how far away it is.
It's near. It's near. It's a near future.
Amelia is the title of the play.
Amelia is...
Is it a set of stories?
It's a play within a play.
Right.
And actually, interestingly enough, there is also a component where actors share a character.
Oh, wow.
Yes, there you go. I like that.
Are you on first or is Amy on first?
not our actors.
Oh, okay.
Just try and try.
We'll be complementing shows, not competing shows.
Exactly. So Amelia is solar punk and it's a play.
Explain that term now, solar punk. I think we know both terms separately for sure.
Yeah, so you've heard of steampunk or cyberpunk. Mm. And I kind of find out there's a cool way to remember it. And so the first word, steam or cyber, refers to the type of energy that kind of civilization or society uses. So in this case, it's solar. So solar power. And then punk refers to the countercultural aspect of it. So in solar punk is a literary and an artistic movement that started on the internet in around 2008. It's very reminiscent of kind of the Whole Earth catalogue or the Earthships, those houses that were kind of built like beehives, hexagonal kind of domes in the Mojave Desert. It's very, for me, it reminds me a lot of kind of the late 1960s, 1970s in America. But it's a movement that's kind of, it's characterized by bicycles, solar power. It's a non-dystopian view of the future. And
so things aren't all terrible.
No, and I really like it because it insists on radical hope. And I think hope is a resource that we actually need more and more of nowadays.
Well, to give me a little sense of how that radical hope was realised through it, Davy and his sister Jan, she has returned home with absolutely no notice, and Davy has a son. Is that the kind of basic
setup? Davy has a young adult child who is non-binary as well. And so actually that's one of the things that I quite liked. I sort of set the task of creating a world where things were possible. So in this world, in our near future here in Ireland, neurodivergence and being non-binary are not problems. So pronouns are not a problem. Mm-hmm. Everybody in the play is quite fluent in pronouns and able to use them without any difficulty, which was very enjoyable to write. And then I just, Jan arrives home. Jan tracks migratory routes of birds. So she goes off for long periods and then comes back. They live on the west coast of Ireland. The weather is very different. The world seems very different. It's just them, and there's allusions to some neighbours. There's a vet who comes and visits. Vet is also the town dentist and security. And Jan arrives back, and on the morning that she arrives back, something unusual flies into the window, and it's a little creature that they've never seen before. And yeah, and then over the course of the next few months, things happen.
Yeah. And there's also an aspect in this that the way theatre is presented in this future is different from the way we see theatre today.
It is, absolutely, yeah. So the premise is basically this is a group of actors putting on the play of Amelia, and during the performance there is an unexpected power cut in the theatre, and so they lose all electricity. And so from that moment on, the show goes off-grid. In real life, it goes off-grid. So the actors on the stage, the real-life actors on the stage, have to generate the power themselves, yeah. Wow. Either by pedaling to kind of light, there's a sort of a lighting display as part of it, or else we're hoping, I mean, this is all hopeful, we're hoping to run the show off car batteries that we're charging at the moment with solar power. So we will be using rechargeable batteries.
On the risk that they could run out of power and you'd have to do something. You'd have to do something on the night.
Yeah, but we will not be charging them by plugging them into the mains.
Right. Oh, right. So you're setting yourself several tasks, not just
we just thought.
Not just putting on a play. One of the things, I mean, all three of you have spoken about writing the plays in the pandemic period, obviously, when we were all so isolated, and in many cases you could go up to your bedroom and spend 2 or 3 hours up there and nobody was going to be bothered by that. Yeah. Theatre is such a collaborative art. It's hugely important that it's not just one person. Talk to me a little bit more, if you would, Amy, about that process when you knew the play was going to be workshopped, and when how Jim Culleton and Gavin Costick helped you develop the play from what you had on the page into something that could go onto a stage.
Yeah, I mean, the text itself didn't actually change hugely in that workshopping period. Was a lot of, because on a page, when you see this concept, I suppose, of multiple actors playing these two characters and when they're going to pass that baton and everything, it was kind of sitting around a table with the actors reading it, going, oh, it worked a year ago when I workshopped it myself. Is it still going to work now? Is it going to, was it a fluke? And then everyone in the room going, wow, yeah, that does work. And then discussing the play and the characters and the world. And yeah, I mean, there were a few notes and text changes,
You're saying that the text essentially didn't change that much. Were you surprised then when you saw it realized on the stage, saying, did I write that?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, I think I kept waiting for when someone pulls a thing or the water, slide, or like the slide. So I was surprised. I was thrilled,
like pleasantly, obviously.
All of the actors that I mean, also because I am an actor, and when I first wrote it, I thought I was doing that actor thing of writing myself a part, and then it kind of just became something else. And to have the satisfaction for the first time of, sitting around hearing the words, appreciating all the actors and not being there, yes. kind of going, oh, when do I have my scene coming up? Yeah. And am I going to trip on my words in a minute? And
surely an actor wouldn't do that.
And then, you know, that's just continued in the rehearsal room, kind of just watching the actors that ultimately in the cast.
Yeah. And just, both yeah. both you, both Dee and Ross have different experiences in terms of Fair City. You were a script editor at one period in time, and Ross, you currently write for
Fair City. I still do work for I used to get absolutely savage edits from Dee.
look, but do you know, well, I made him what he is.
Yeah, true, true. Very good. But J.K. Simmons and Whiplash kind of situation. Yeah.
I wondered though, writing for something like Fair City, where you know there's a very definite structure there. There are characters in place and you're probably told this has to happen in this episode, will you realise that for us? That simple journeyman style of writing, how important is that in the development, or was it in the development of your craft?
It's funny, it's not something I'm actually able to properly quantify, and it's something that other people, I think when, you know, rewrites are called for, like in the process, let's even say this play, and then, you know, like an hour or two later I come back with the rewrites and people are like, where did this come? I was like, oh, I just did it because you're just kind of, I think, used to, particularly when it comes to like something like a soap opera, it's just like, you have this time, people need the thing like yesterday and it just needs to happen now because they're on set filming or they're whatever the thing is, and you just have to go. And like, I think it kind of instills, I don't know, economy of speed, precision, whatever it is, into the whole thing. Because the book stops with you. You just have to get it done.
Kind of maybe a ruthlessness in terms of, you know, when you're looking at a scene that you're maybe not as attached to, let's say, in a soap opera, you can go, no, that line needs to go, that line needs to go, no, she moves, needs to do that quicker. You're not emotionally attached to it. And I guess as an editor, you'd have that. I wondered, did you put your editor's hat on to your own script in the case of Amelia?
There was certainly...
Your play, Dee.
There was one thing that was... one massive takeaway that I got from when I was working on Fair City, and it was that we used to always have to, when we were working on scripts, we had to make sure that the writers left enough room for everyone else to do their job. So you had to make sure that the writer didn't dictate the direction, didn't, you know, left enough room for actors to be able to make choices. And that was something that I have found very valuable. So when I write now, I try to be really cognizant of the fact that it is collaborative, that a script is hugely collaborative, and you have to allow other people to come in and have their vision. Now, obviously, there's times where you're like, no, please do it this way. But you do try and allow that flexibility, because there is a huge joy in seeing what other people, like you were saying, Amy, about seeing actors bringing it to life, or seeing how someone else interprets something. And I've absolutely seen that with Amelia. There's choices coming out that I suppose layers that I didn't realise are there. And then you have that sensation of, oh my God, did I write that?
A good sensation, I would hope.
A great sensation, absolutely.
Well, listen, congratulations to all three. Best of luck with the productions as they happen in the Dublin Theatre Festival. May this be the debut, but the first of many for all three of you. Breaking, I'm going to need a drink now. Breaking by Amy Kidd opens at Drake in Blanchardstown. That's on the 2nd of October, runs through until the 5th. There are previews in the Drigheda Arts Centre previous to that on the 26th through to the 28th of September. And then as part of Dublin Theatre Festival at Drake, and it transfers to the Everyman in Cork for the 8th and 9th of October. Content by Ross Dungan is at the Project Arts Centre, the Cube Space, from the 9th through until the 19th of October. And Amelia.
Yeah.
Amelie's the film. Amelia by T. Roycroft is also at the Project Arts Centre in the Cube Space, just ahead of Ross's productions, the 26th of September through until the 5th of October. You can find out full details of those productions and everything else happening at the festival on dublintheatrefestival.ie. Since her 2008 debut, Telex from Cuba, Rachel Kushner has proved herself to be one of America's most intellectually curious novelists, blending challenging political and cultural ideas with strikingly original plots. The latest novel, Creation Lake, follows Sadie Smith, 34-year-old American undercover agent who's cool, intelligent and ruthless. and she is sent by her mysterious but very powerful employers to a remote corner of France. Her mission is to infiltrate a commune of radical eco-activists led by a charismatic puppet master named Bruno Lacombe. The book is at once a political thriller, a history of French political movements, a collection of academic theories about the prehistoric age, and a philosophical novel about human nature. Hardly surprising that the Booker Prize judging panel, who have included it on their long list, have referred to it as an irresistible page-turner, and I'm delighted that Rachel Kushner joins me once again on the programme this evening. Nice to be speaking with you again, Rachel.
Nice to be speaking to you, Sean.
Listen, I've listed at once a thriller, a history of French political movements, a collection of academic theories about the prehistoric age, and a philosophical novel about human nature. That doesn't cover it at all. There's a whole bundle of ideas going on here.
But I might offer an amendment or complication to the idea of academic theories of prehistory, because as the novel begins, the first two lines are, "Neanderthals were prone to depression," he said. "They were prone to addiction, too, and especially smoking." I didn't get that from any tome on cultural anthropology. It's Bruno's own set of speculations into the time before the written down.
Yeah, so yes, they aren't actual theories. They are these theories that you have given to Bruno to send out from his cave where he has placed himself to the world and whoever might read them. But I am interested to know, was there one particular aspect of the book that was kind of nudging at you for a long time and saying, you need to write about me?
Yeah, yes, there was. I mean, there are many threads to it, but for a long time, I have been interested in setting a book in the world of young people who decamp from Paris to build a communal life in a very rural part of France that's experienced a lot of out-migration, where it's difficult to farm, and they would be set on a collision course with the French police and the French state. And that's in part inspired by the good fortune I've had to be exposed to and have some associations with people who have attempted these kinds of utopian experiences and have run afoul of the French state. And I wanted to build my own version of such. The part that came the latest was making the narrator a kind of devil, really, somebody who infiltrates this group and means harm by them, because my own purview would be much more sympathetic
towards those activists. I think you have, I don't know for how many years now you've been doing it with your family, but I think you decamped to Paris for large clumps of the summer, if not all of the summer.
Not Paris, but...
Oh, sorry, to France, I beg your pardon.
Yeah, no, I knew that's what you meant. But what some people call La France profonde, deep rural part of France, I set the book in a region that is fictionally called the Guienne. And that name is taken from a former large swath of southern Western France. There was a region called the Guienne, a very large region from like the year 1200 until the French Revolution. And the place that we go is somewhere within the Guienne. And so I was able to use details that are very familiar from a part of France that is entirely subtended by caves. Underground caves that fill with water, caves that have paintings in them, caves that still have partisan graffiti from World War II when people were hiding from the Nazis that rampaged through. And so it's a world that I am familiar with and was able to furnish my parallel universe with some of its features.
And I think the physicality and the reality of spending time in a cave, is that a train going past the window?
I'm in New York City, so that was a subway.
That's the subway.
Apologies.
It's hardly the subway going past the window. It's the subway going somewhere underneath you. At any rate, I've totally lost my train of thought. Yes, the caves, the physicality and the reality of spending time in caves. Did you do the hard research on that particular aspect things of Rachel, or am I right in thinking that perhaps there was a family member who could help?
Yes, nice hint there. So, you know, I never really think of what I do as research because I write on the occasion of or into worlds that I've acquired some knowledge of, a little bit of authority about in a kind of natural, organic way. And, you know, when you're a member of a family, sometimes you annex the intelligence and experiences and knowledge of the people who share your home. I go to this part of France, and my son, starting when he was 7, went to this very rural camp with French children whose fathers work as tractor dealers or firemen or sell crepes at the fair. And he was among a group of people who had a very intimate relationship with the land and the place. And he started going into caves in this camp when he was 7. And the last 2 years, he was a counselor at the camp and guiding children into caves. I've been into the caves that tourists can go in to see painted caves or, you know, some of the residue of cave bears and cave bear scratches on the walls. But my son Remy has gone into caves that are just on some farmer's property or covered by a manhole cover on the side of the road. And he's wearing a wetsuit and wading through neck deep, very cold water for a mile underground. And so he has a lot of knowledge of the details, and he would tell me about these caves. And it did allow me to see or to imagine that I see what Bruno sees underground.
Yeah. Yes, I wondered if as he sat at the dinner table telling you all of that, you had the notebook out and jotted and wrote furiously. Or did you just listen and say, why are you doing that? Was the maternal instinct in there at the same time?
I try to write secretly because he's on to me at this point. But I did... I did ask him, you know, what he thought of what I wrote. He agreed to read an excerpt of my novel that was in Granta magazine, British literary magazine. And he said, I liked it. It was good. It was pretty accurate. He said, the one thing is you make it seem like Bruno gets in there pretty easily. And he said, in my experience is generally like 45 minutes to an hour of scooting myself through a crevice so narrow that I can't even turn my head.
Wow. Yeah. Even reading about it makes me uncomfortable. I don't know how people put themselves into such confined spaces, but they do. However, you said, Rachel, that the aspect of the novel that came to you latest was the character of Sadie, who is our narrator. And much has been made, I think, in reviews and in talk about the book, about this page-turning aspect of it and the fact that there is a spy thriller aspect to it via the person of Sadie. She really is cool, detached, indifferent, and nasty.
Yeah. So as I was putting this book, I was thinking about the book, there was like 3 years of sort of building on the structure and the ideas of the book before the actual execution of writing it. And I had witnessed over the years a few, I would say, key stories in the media, but also secondhand to me through my social world, of people working undercover who had been sent to infiltrate leftist activists, one of which, a British agent, is a quite high-profile story. You probably know Mark Kennedy, who was infiltrating green anarchist groups in Germany and France and the UK. And he had affairs with a bunch of different women in these groups. That's not really part of the work assignment and is considered rogue activity. And there was quite a bit of fallout from it. Several of these women ended up suing the Metropolitan UK police. And from what I understand, the agent himself countersued the Metropolitan Police for, quote unquote, failing to protect him from falling in love. And I had been following these stories because Mark Kennedy had infiltrated a group called Tarnak, who are people I'm familiar with, who were in the northern Corrèze and were raided by the French police, who seized as evidence 3,000 books from a library. And I kept asking myself, what kind of a person would do this? Mark Kennedy was kind of famously sloppy and having all of these affairs with women. And maybe Sadie is my answer to myself of what kind of person would do it. And I made her a bit less sloppy than Mark Kennedy. And she certainly thinks of herself as a woman who makes no mistakes.
Yeah, and she does become involved, and we don't need to go into the details of it, in an unrequited love, where the man is very deeply, it would seem, in love with her, but certainly she's using it for her own purposes. However, as the novel progresses, it struck me that Sadie, becomes rather seduced by Bruno Lacombe and his ideas rather than doing what she should be doing, what her employers want her to do, which is to get rid of him effectively. These silent employers, did you have people in mind for them?
You know, I really didn't, but I had in mind, so there's a sub-minister, a French sub-minister who works in the Ministry of Rural Coherence, which isn't really a real ministry in France, and he is slightly not too dissimilar from a former French politician named Manuel Valls, who was in fact prime minister. But I didn't think I had it in me to knock off a prime minister. So I demoted him to a less significant, less celebrated role in the French government. In terms of who her employers are, she says, you know, people who have vested interests, either from the side of government or from the side of private enterprise, in these large-scale farming projects in rural France. There's a scene where she's having drinks with her quote-unquote boyfriend, a person she's sidled up to, only in order to have access to the commune. And he's from a high-born family in Paris, and they're having drinks at the Hotel Marais, a place I myself have been. And I noticed while there, I was taken there by someone else, that in fact, the captains of industry and French judges and French ministers are in that bar having drinks. And as I remembered being there myself, I thought, as I deposited Sadie in the hushed, elegant environment with the low lighting, that the men around her, it dawns on her, if they are not the people who hired for her for this job, they might as well be, because it's men like this.
Yeah, for sure. There's that sense of it. Finally, again, much talk about there is an ambiguity in the ending of the novel. Sadie came to you last in terms of this novel. Is she still lurking around your imagination somewhere? Will we see more of her?
That's so insightful, Sean. You know, with most of my novels, or with all of them up until now, I sort of feel like the world of the book is eternal. It exists. It can be opened up again as soon as you open the book, but it doesn't stretch beyond the book's covers. Mm. And in this case, you know, Sadie, well, I don't know if I want to give away what happens at the end of the book, but, you know, she may be primed for another job. I just don't know right now. But there's a possibility there that she could come back.
And I would hazard a guess that Rachel Kushner might be primed for another novel before too long in the process. Great, lovely to speak with you again this evening, Rachel. And a safe trip when you're coming to us at the end of the month.
Thank you so much, Sean. Lovely to speak with you as well. Rachel, an honour and a privilege.
Not at all. Thank you. Rachel Kushner there, who will be speaking about her novel, Creation Lake, and she'll be speaking with Carlo Gebler at this year's Write by the Sea Festival at Kilmore Quay in Wexford. That talk takes place on Saturday, the September the 28th, and Creation Lake is published by Penguin. Robert Ames is a composer, conductor and curator, often working in the worlds of new music, pop, electronic and film music. He has worked closely with leading figures like Philip Glass, Bryce Dessner, Nico Muhly, Johnny Greenwood and Steve Reich. Recent collaborations include Taylor Swift, Little Sims and Self Esteem. And next month, he conducts the RTE Concert Orchestra at the National Concert Hall in Dublin in an event called Beyond the Console. Together, they will perform an evening of classic gaming scores, Final Fantasy 8, in fact, to Fallout 4. And I'm sure a few of the other numbers in between as well. Delighted that Robert Ames joins me on the line this evening. When I look at the range of music that you have been involved in and are involved in continuously, Robert, I don't know who you associate the saying, you know, there's only two types of music, good and bad. Some say Rossini, some say Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong. For years, I thought it was Berlioz. I don't know who said it, but whoever said it was right, obviously. And somehow that has been part, I think, of your musical philosophy all along.
Yeah, for a while, it's really great to be with you. It's all subjective, I guess. It's all about personal taste. But yeah, for a long time, I've been listening to like a really broad spectrum of music. Keeps me happy.
And you grew up in a music. You grew up in a musical family. Was there a broad spectrum music played and listened to at home?
Yeah, my parents weren't musicians, but they're really keen to give me and my two sisters a musical education. So we all played a string instrument growing up, and we would have all sorts of music on at home: jazz, prog rock, pop music of the day. We're listening to Britpop a lot and classical music a lot. Yeah, so loads of stuff.
And as a when you're listening to all of that as a child, I'm guessing you don't make any distinction, or did you?
I think I was aware of what I was listening to, but it's just really about kind of what I liked and what I enjoyed. And I guess at that age, you don't have the weight of kind of all the information that comes with it. So you could listen to a Berlioz symphony, or you could listen to some Aphex Twin and just enjoy them both equally. I've tried to keep hold of that spirit growing up.
Yeah, and obviously in your career you have managed to do that. And this upcoming concert, the concentration is on gaming music. I've noted in my own children, they love listening to the gaming music and kind of variations. There'll be one version of, you know, whatever character it is in a gaming score, and then you get a slight variation on a different instrument for a different scene. And they're kind of switching between these with great ease and with great joy. It is a real kind of a door opening experience in terms of orchestral music.
Yeah, it's a really beautiful thing. There's so many amazing symphonic scores for gaming music at the moment. And you think about how often games are played and how many people play video games. And, you know, you're in these worlds for hours and weeks and months on end, and you're getting to know this music intimately as you play the game. So, yeah, it's introducing a whole new generation and a whole new group of people to orchestral music, which makes me really happy.
And one of the big orchestral scores that will be featured on the night is the music of Koji Kondo, and this is the Legend of Zelda Suite. Let's have a listen to a little bit of it first of all, and we'll chat a bit further about it afterwards, Robert.
Grant.
The opening section there of Koji Kondo's Legend of Zelda Suite, drawn from the music from the gaming score, was the London Philharmonic Orchestra who are playing there, conducted by Andrew Skeet. That is one of the pieces, I do believe, that Robert Ames will conduct with the RT Concert Orchestra at the upcoming concert of gaming music. I wanted to start with that, Robert, because when I put it on and was listening to it, I thought, well, Koji Kondo has heard a few John Williams scores along the way, that's for sure, but it has that big cinematic feel to it, which I think is quite prevalent in gaming music, in lots of gaming music.
Yeah, absolutely. Like big color, big orchestration, like very much in the realms of John Williams and all of the great classical composers before him, Rimsky-Korsakov, you know, all of that color and brilliance. But the thing that really stands out about this one for me is that melody. It's a real earworm. You get that a lot in gaming music, like an incredible ability for these composers to write melodies that are extremely memorable.
Yeah, and the other aspect of that struck me about it's a suite that is drawn from the music. Is it by Kondo himself? Did he draw the suite from the music that he's made for the games? If you think about ballet music, the same thing is often done. The Nutcracker suite being a case in point.
Yeah, it's a very interesting thing. I mean, these video game music concerts and film concerts are kind of a new addition to the orchestral world. So a lot of the time it's outside arrangers and orchestrators working on these suites. And I believe the suite that we're playing is by Kondo, obviously, but arranged by Andrew Skeet in this case.
So who we heard conducting that that particular version that recording. There also within the gaming world, because it can sometimes be an isolated experience. It can be the one person, and you're following something very intimately on the screen. There can be very atmospheric sections to it. I want to listen to some of the music of Jessica Curry here. This is from an album called Dear Esther. You might know the game involved, but let's have a listen to this piece first of all. In fact, I see that Dear Esther is a first-person game about love, loss, guilt, and redemption. There we have it, Robert Imms. That music is about love, loss, guilt, and redemption. It's incredibly atmospheric.
Yeah, incredibly atmospheric and so concise as well. You know, there's not a lot of notes there. There's not a lot happening, but it's the... You know, it's the precision and the confidence of a composer to say a lot of things with a few notes.
And the effects that we heard there, which are kind of vocal effects, will you be able to recreate that type of thing on the night, or do you find another way of doing that with the instruments, or how do you go about it?
Yeah, so Jessica has made a special arrangement of this piece, which is a lot more orchestral, actually. So it's a kind of symphonic rendition of this piece of music, and it's kind of interspersed and connected to another one of her gaming scores.
Talk to me a little bit about Hildur Guðnadóttir's, if I'm saying her name, Guðnadóttir, I suppose it would be. She's an Icelandic composer, I'm guessing from that name. Her score for Battlefields.
Yeah, so Hildur Guðnadóttir, super close, and Sam Slater. You know, Hildur's a legend in the film music world, Oscar winner for Joker, and it kind of shows you where... You know, gaming music is at the moment to draw on that caliber of composer, really. Kind of have to remind myself sometimes that the gaming industry is, you know, it's bigger than the film, TV and music industry put together. You just can't imagine the amount of people that are involved in it around the world. And for me, it's really interesting that an Oscar winner like Hildur was brought in to do this game and work with electronics and work with and work in a way that she hasn't before with Sam Slater to create a really kind of industrial, brooding, brutal score for this war game.
Yeah, Battlefield 2042. Let's have a listen to a bit of it. Yeah, not hard to work out why Hildur Guðnadóttir is such a successful composer. Again, she does so much with relatively little notes, really, in that. And it's just this big, strong rhythm moving it along. That, I suppose, would be closer in many ways to some of the electronic projects and even the Sigur Rós stuff that you've been involved in, Robert, would it?
There's like a big, there's a big kind of industrial dance music influence in there for sure. The way that piece comes together in concert is a kind of electro acoustic hybrid. So it's loads of percussion, the orchestra doing all sorts of interesting extended techniques blended with electronics. It's pretty filthy, and it makes the room shake.
And it will make the National Concert Hall shake, I'm sure.
Hope so.
On the 26th. Lovely to speak with you this evening, Robert, and hope to see you when you get over for the concert. Best of luck.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks very much.
That's Robert Ames, who will conduct the RTE Concert Orchestra at Beyond the Console at the National Concert Hall. It's on the 26th of October, and certainly that music has whetted my appetite. rte.ie/CO for further details on that. And that is our lot for this Monday evening. Leah Murphy researched. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Mark McGrath was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. I will be back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, here on RTE Radio 1. And I do believe Ray Cuddihy is still in the seat. He will be with you after the 8 o'clock news.